He would have gone.
Let's get started. I got a lot of stuff to try to get through this morning. How many of you guys read this chapter? Nobody's doing their homework. I don't get this.
Homework?
I'm going to have to give y'all some in-school suspensions, in-church suspensions.
I'll take mine tomorrow night.
Oh, okay.
You, no.
Yeah. You got to practice by yourself tomorrow night since you didn't read your homework.
I'm going to take mine.
This is a very involved chapter. It has a lot of history and a lot of facts in it. Very long chapter if you haven't read it. But it is beneficial, and it is really good to read and to read all the details and everything. But I'm not going to be able to get into all the details, obviously. So I'm just going to kind of hit the highlights of what he talks about in the chapter. And then next week we're going to take a little bit more of a practical look at it and see the effects. Today's lesson is on the preacher, or the pastor, as he calls it, or minister. You know, that's the idea that we're discussing. And basically, what he talks about in this chapter is the idea of a preeminent person within the congregation.
Singular
person, right? Not the idea that pastors or elders or those sort of thing, you know, are not biblical, because we know they are. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. But the idea of a preeminent person in the church. Who is the most identifiable member of the modern church?
Preacher.
Preacher, the pastor in the denominational world, right?
We still get asked that. People say, where do you attend? Who's the minister?
Okay, second question is, who's the minister? You see church buses driving around, and it says, such and such Holy Gospel Church, and it says on the bottom, what?
Pastor
Bill Smith. Sometimes it says, Pastor, Dr. Reverend Bill Smith. Okay? Elder, Pastor, Dr. Reverend Smith. Okay? As many titles as we can possibly put on their name to give them, it lends more credibility, right? To put, you know, Reverend, Dr., Pastor Bill Smith, you know, or whatever. That doesn't make any sense, right? They all mean the same thing. It's like Elder, 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 Elder Smith. You know, they're all basically the same words that are being used. Except for what really sometimes gets me confused is for somebody to call themselves, to allow themselves to be called Reverend. And the Bible talks very clearly about, you know, the idea of the only one that should be lifted up in that and be revered is God. But the point is that and a church preaches a gospel meeting, and they want to always advertise who the guy speaking is. On the church sign says such and such church, and at the bottom it says minister blah so and so, and it's among all churches. Now I understand that probably in the denominational world, the pastor is seen as a little bit more of a central figure. Okay, the minister in the denominational world. But as we're going to talk about probably more next week, to a lesser degree, but to a degree that's probably not healthy, we emphasize that role as well in the church. And so, when you look at the most identifiable member of a church, and the thing is, you say, well, who's your preacher? Bobby Jones. Ah, don't know who he is. Okay? We're not going to know who these guys are, right? I mean, it's like I've even seen church buses with the picture of the pastor on the side of the bus.
You're not getting
picture one. Of the. And there was, and this is among all church groups.
We want people,
but especially among, it seems like among the Pentecostal churches, it's even more pronounced. Like, you know, Cornerstone. Oh, well, that's where Pastor Mari Davis is. You know, or that's where such and such is. They are the, you know, the one that is seen as that is identified.
I think even to the point where it's not even, they're not even considered a member. You said, what's the most important member of the church? Well, they're the pastor, and then everybody else will know the members.
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly what we're gonna talk about. Yeah.
I think on the opposite, you talk about denomination. At least in my experience in the brotherhood, the preacher is the one. And when I was a youth minister, I noticed that it's not the elders that they call on to be seen at the hospital. They want the preacher to be there. So even in Churches of Christ, I think we maybe not here.
Okay, along those lines, what is the role of the modern preacher, modern minister, modern pastor, as the denominational world calls this person? What is their role, their function?
Everything but song leading.
Okay.
That's really something.
Okay. Which would be what?
Everything.
Okay. Primary duty.
Preach.
What?
Preach.
Okay. Mm-hmm. To be the one that preaches every time that they're there. Okay. Every time that they can possibly be in the pulpit, to be the one to preach, they're going to be in the pulpit. Okay. They are the voice of God to that congregation. I don't mean in some weird way. I just mean they're the one that is seen as the appropriate one, or the one that needs to be imparting the word. Okay? What else?
Office hours.
Okay. They are the administrative head. Whether they ever want to say anything about that, they are the administrative head of the church. Most of the times it's the secretary, but which is not good. Sorry, Barbara. They have a lot of administrative duties, right? Somebody comes in. I'll give you an example. We go upstairs for the worship this morning, and somebody comes to the door and I need some help. What's your immediate response, Dave? Well, I don't have anything to do with anything. I'm not a pastor, preacher, minister, anything. I'm just a member, just like y'all. But automatically, we want to think of that one person, right, that we can go to. At Rivergate, it was, Sellers. Sellers! We got somebody. Well, Sellers had nothing to do with the money. He had nothing to do with that part of the... But that's what we automatically think, is they handle all the administrative responsibilities, right? So, and in the denominational world, it really is true. A lot of times, they do handle the administrative responsibilities. Sometimes in the denominational world, they handle the finances as well. Okay, what else?
Funerals.
Okay, weddings and funerals. Okay? What else?
Study. They know the Bible.
Okay, they have to be, they have to spend a lot of time studying. Okay? Taking time to study the Word. And I know that, and many ministers, and that's definitely nothing wrong with this, but they take that role very seriously, right? I know. At Rivergate, Sellers was very, very, very studious, and he would spend 10 to 12 hours on every sermon that he preached, studying and going through it. And he was very thorough in his study. He'd have a stack of books this tall on his desk. I was like, dude, how do you do that every week? Two sermons a week plus a Bible class, and he's got books this high. How do you do that? What else?
Minister to the sick.
All right, visit the sick. In the hospitals, at home. They also visit those that are spiritually sick, those that haven't been there in a while. Visit the visitors. Yeah. Right? So visitation. What else?
Counsel.
Okay. That's another one I put down. Counsel. Somebody comes in with a problem. Who are you going to send them to? Sellers, Whoever the preacher is. You're going to just shuffle them in their office. Whether they have any... And Sellers did have a lot of experience. But whether they have experience or not, whatever the problem is, you shuffle them to the minister because nobody else wants to deal with it. That's not really it, right? That's not it. It's that they're more in tune with how, they can help people. No, it's just most people don't want to deal with it. It's my benevolence. You just want to throw that off as quick as you can on somebody else, right? Yeah.
No, we have been ingrained with the mentality that that's his job.
It's his job. Okay, now tell me something. How many people does it take to do all those things?
A village.
Is it possible for one person to do all those things and to do all of them well? Yeah. Okay? I don't know how some men do it. I really don't. And he mentions this in the chapter, the very end of the chapter. Because he's definitely not knocking on guys who are tasked with this and try to do it. to the best of their abilities.
Which is why they're moved around a lot.
Okay?
Because the people get so disheartened with, oh, he cannot fulfill the expectations we have of him, and yet no one can. So either he leaves, or they get tired of him.
I think on that you keep going back to the power of the preacher. If a preacher leaves a congregation, it can cause a split over the preacher. They're looked at as the person of the church. And another thing that they're also required to do, it's small, but I think task them, is to go to all the older adult classes throughout the week, whether there's Rivergate had a faith and works class, who had to be there?
Teach a lot of extra classes.
That people wouldn't know about on the normal side. I know at Bethel, James always had to be, and if he couldn't be there, guess who they wanted to be there in his place? The youth minister, which obviously you know. So I think they're required to be at all these events because they're the figurehead, they're the representation of the church. And so if you have the preacher there, you know, it's
and one of the main reasons for that is they're paid to do so. And so, unfortunately, there's this attitude prevalent in a lot of elderships, but also in a lot of churches, that, you know, that's what we pay you to do. So when I call you to, you know, you should be preaching every Sunday, and you should be teaching Bible classes every Sunday and Wednesday, and you should be, anytime we call you to do anything in the middle of the night or whatever, because that's what you're paid to do. That's your job. You're paid to do that. And if you've ever seen, and Sean knows all about this, if you've ever seen a job description, ministerial job description, you know, it's like, you know, and then it says at the end, and any other stuff that we decide needs to be done.
You know, it's in the
okay.
Small print.
Literally, you know, that's the way it is a lot of times. It says, and anything else at the discretion of the elders.
Well, yeah.
You know, so.
Well, my God.
Here's the problem. One of the problems, and we're gonna get more into this next week. You wear guys out, who their passion is serving. Most ministers are in it because it's in their heart to serve other people and to preach the word and to do the things that they are tasked to do. Most guys really love to do that. Just like everybody, though, they have strengths and weaknesses. You know, some are better at visiting, and some are better at preaching, and some are better at serving, and some are, you know, and so you totally wear, in most cases, you can wear a person down, and it becomes just a job after a while. I can tell you from experience that happens, because that's where I was about 7 years ago. It was just a job for me. I was going to church, and I was just hoping to get through it. Let's sing at 8 and 10, and then I was, you know, then I had to teach a class, and then I had to do, you know, then I had to, you know, empty the trash cans, and then, you know, just all these different tasks, you know, anything at a day, you know, it's just like, okay, guys. And so it became a job. And that's a real danger. Number two is it stifles the gifts and abilities of everybody else. There's a lot of people that are great at visiting. There's a lot of people that are great at serving, that are great at speaking, that are great at doing all the things that a minister sometimes gets piled on top of him, but can't do it all. But yet the attitude is, well, that's what we pay him for, or that's what we pay them for. So, we don't really have enough people, so we'll hire a visitation minister. It would be his job as visitation, but then what happens is they find other areas that aren't working right. So they, well, we need you to do this and this too and this too. You know, it can work both ways. What are the requirements to be a modern preacher or pastor?
College degree.
Okay, college degree.
Master's now.
Okay, as high a degree as you can possibly get, and always working toward the next one. Okay, always working toward the next one. It didn't used to be like that, okay, back in the 50s and 60s, but it's gotten to the point to where you will not get a preaching job unless you have a degree. I'll tell you a good example. A good friend of mine was one of the best ministers, preachers, evangelists I've ever met. Self-taught. Bill Johnson. He was looked down upon by most people because he didn't have a degree. He didn't have the seminary degree. He hadn't had this. So, you know, he did eventually get an honorary doctorate from somewhere. And he thought, you know, he was just like, He's just like, well, here's a piece of paper. You know, so he said, here's a piece of paper. I'll use it, you know, let me write some notes on the back. You know, that's about how he felt about it. But he had other brothers who were saying, dude, you need to advance your degree. You need to, so you have a little bit more prestige in the preaching community. So, degree, what else? You have to be a trained communicator. Okay, trained. Not just somebody that's pretty good at speaking. You need to be a trained communicator. All right? What else? Because that's how you're judged, by the way, right? As a preacher, as a minister. People don't see the stuff you do in the background, except for the people that you're helping, you're doing it with, that you're helping. The one that you're at the hospital till 2 in the morning because their family member is dying. Or the one that you're at the funeral home, you know, for 3 straight days, you know, lending your help to the family. Or whatever the case is, all the background stuff. You're judged on your preaching, your speaking ability. And if you're not any good at it, if you're not as good as some people think you should be, then you know you're gonna be looked down on. This person should be a Bible scholar. Okay, they should know the Greek, and they should know the Hebrew, and they should know the background, and they should spend umpteen hours a week studying, and they should and all these things. But you should be, if there's a Bible question, who do you go to? You want to be able to go to your preacher, right, and say, I have this question about the book of Revelation, you know, and what do you think about, you know, and you want him to be able to give you an answer, and then as soon as he gives you the answer, then what does that answer become? That's it. Okay, so then when I go out and I go talk to my friend who has a different bit, well, I use the same exact stuff that he said, right? And sometimes they can say, well, my preacher said, and he's trained at such and such seminary, you know, or such and such college. He has a doctorate. He has, you know, 5 doctorates. You know, this is what he says. And so, you know, I'm going to go with that answer. The last one is, in most religions, okay, in most church groups, you have to be what's called ordained. Okay? Ordained. That word is biblical. But not in the sense, and we're going to hit that hopefully here toward the end. That word is biblical, but it's not in the sense that we have used it to that. We've come to use it today. What does the word mean, ordained?
Today?
Yeah, today.
Master of ceremonies.
Okay, what else?
Set aside.
Okay, what else?
In today's, it kind of means you're the, like the master of the topic, of the biblical topic.
Okay, do you know, well...
It actually means that you have the approval of the church.
Yes.
Okay? The approval of the church. But not only approval of the church, but also ordination is seen as approval of the world as well. Okay, of the government. Okay? Somebody comes to Sean and says, hey, will you do a wedding? What's the first question you get?
Well,
are you an ordained minister?
Yeah.
Well, in the same sense, see, you don't have to be an ordained minister in order to do ceremonies. In some places, you do. You have to be recognized, officially recognized by not only the church or by the government as a minister. Okay, you're set aside and you're put up on a pedestal as somebody. Fortunately, that is not the case in Tennessee and Arkansas and a few other places. Wait, I think it is in Arkansas. Sorry, guys. I had some kind of an official letter or something. Yeah, see, for their wedding. In Arkansas, they had to fill an official letter that I was a minister, you know, of a particular church. You know? So basically, in order to do their wedding, they lied. It's really not.
We didn't know that. Wait.
So it didn't really take. So,
oh, okay. Well, good.
For some reason, in the state of Tennessee, anybody can do a wedding because you can do a civil or a religious or civil ceremony, and so. You can be a teacher, or you can be a judge, or whatever. But in most places, ordained. If you don't have those papers that say you're ordained, you're not. It's the same in New York too, by the way. When I did Blakeman's wedding,
you can be a captain of a boat.
Captain of a boat. Yes. Yeah. So you know, so lots of captain of a boat, ordained minister. You know,
about the same.
About the same. Okay. So the question is this. What would happen in the modern church today without the role of the preacher or pastor or minister?
Very little.
What would happen?
No, we're finding out, aren't we?
Nothing would get done.
Okay? We're doing the experiment here. In most places, okay, we're a little different here, obviously. In most places, what would happen?
Attendance goes down.
Yeah, you would lose members most definitely.
Okay, probably lose members. Because the first two questions people ask in the Church of Christ is, who's your minister and do you have elders? Right? And if you don't meet those two requirements, then there's something really wrong. Attendance would go down.
You don't have to worry about that here.
What?
Attendance going down.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. It's about as low as it's going to get. Especially after lessons like last week. I mean, you just run them off. I mean, it's a good lesson, Chris. Would most churches even consider the possibility of not having a minister, preacher?
Not at all.
No. An official preacher, paid preacher?
No.
And a lot of members hide behind that. I mean, like, around here, the men have stepped up and do fulfill a lot of those roles, the preaching and things like that. But in a lot of churches, I know the men would not be comfortable with that. And so they would go, I mean, they almost hide behind someone who does it every week. That's how they've done it forever. So you take away their minister, they're going to go somewhere else that has a minister that they can hide behind almost. I mean, I think that is a stifling. I mean, like you said, it stifles their gifts. But I think that's a fear that a lot of men have, is having to.
But that, they're step part up. Of it. But the other part is that the stigma attached to it is so high,
mm-hmm.
no one wants to take on
that.
The difficulty that comes with that attachment. Because at that point, you have to be beyond human, because everything you do is looked at with a microscope. Your kids have to be perfect. Your wife has to be perfect. You have to be perfect. And not just when you're in the building, but every minute you're awake. And when you're sleeping, because they're probably watching them. Because we think, once you become an ordained minister, you're no longer human. And so, I understand why most places would say, I don't want to be that person, because immediately everything that goes wrong is your responsibility. Everything that should be done is your responsibility, when there's hundreds of people out there that should be doing every bit of it, but transfer all of their responsibility onto some one person.
And then you get labeled. Then, you know, I've heard PK kids, you know, the preacher kids, and then you get the golden ticket to get into heaven, and usually those kids are the ones that end up.
Yeah, we're definitely gonna touch on that. We're gonna touch on that next week about the pressure.
I've heard that.
The pressures of being in this role, but also the pressures of trying to be the family of a person in this role. Okay?
Now, even now, if the trend is to have an interim preacher, while you're choosing a new preacher. You hire somebody to come in for a year or whatever.
Like college football.
He has a doctorate, and he has all the qualifications. Comes in and interimizes for a certain period. But you can't do that. You can't do without a preacher while you're looking for another preacher.
Well, that's right. Actually,
hire somebody to come in.
Yeah, the congregation I was thinking of, did that just happen? Their minister decided, I need to go someplace else that needs me more than I need to be here. The congregation of 500 people. Right? 500 people. The minister, out of the blue, no one expected it, said, I'm going to leave in a month. They hired someone to fill in. There are 400 people, and I know at least 6 personally, that have doctorate degrees that are retired ministers that could have stepped up and said, we'll do it. But didn't. Because the elders wouldn't ask them to. And the congregation won't do anything without the elders saying, this is what we should do. And so therefore, it was sad. Because when I was talking to them, they said, what do y'all do? And I told them what we're doing. They said, that's a wonderful idea. It'll never happen here. Because we don't have 14 men that would be willing to step and do that. And there's no way we could find 7 that would stand up and lead singing. There's 500 people there.
Yeah. Well, and that comes from years of not of non-training, right? Years of not expecting it to be done.
Years of expecting someone else to do it for me.
Exactly.
I think that the issue goes back in a lot of churches is that for the average person who doesn't study their Bible would think it's not biblical. If you tell somebody right now that we don't have a preacher, then they're going to be like, some people are like, oh, that's really neat, but deep down, you know, they're probably thinking that's not right.
Maybe not as much so as thinking that it's not biblical, that it's not biblical not to have one. Let me see what I'm trying to say here. That it's the example of the Bible is that they had one. That's what I'm saying. That it's not biblical not to have one,
right.
But the example of the Bible want to be like the Church of the New Testament, then we have to have one because that's what the examples teach. And that's, and I think you're right about, you know, just a lack of understanding. Let me throw this out before we get into it, just about 5 minutes of nonstop, 10 minutes of nonstop history. Is it possible that it would be the opposite reaction? After the initial shock and awe of coming to that conclusion, coming to that decision, is it possible that the opposite would happen? That natural leaders would emerge, and that the congregation would go on even better than it was. Is that possible? The congregation I've had some experience with is my friend Lee's church in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And Lee went there after they had started. It was basically a bunch of people who they couldn't find a place that they really felt comfortable with in that city, and so they started meeting together in a school, just a very small group of them. And now they're 250. And they don't have any paid staff. They don't have a minister, somebody that is even perceived as ministers, even though they have 7 retired ministers in their congregation. They take turns speaking and preaching, and those guys they're not seen as elevated because of their background. But the congregation is led by their elders. The elders are the ones that organize. The elders are the ones that try to keep things going, that visit and keep the congregation moving and encourage people to use their gifts and their talents. And they continue to grow. They continue, you know, for people to see the way that things are done there, and people think it's weird and they visit and they're like, this is great. And so it's possible that one of the two, like Betsy said, okay, we'll have to find somebody else, or it wouldn't happen, and it would stifle the growth, or the opposite effect would happen. That people would see that, you know, that role is not really one that is needed or required within a congregation in order to grow. For us, as much as anything, it was financial for us. You know, it just wasn't anything that we could continue to do. It wasn't, and nothing against, you know, nothing against Tom. But he was not here. When most of us came here, he had been here and had been here for several years. Not anybody that we had chosen, but anybody that we had any say in being here in that position and that role. And all the expectation fell on him, and he was only part-time, right? And then that's even worse, to have all that pressure, all that stuff put on your head. Expectation for a guy that works another full-time job and then has a part-time job. Yeah, it'll just throw it all. Say what?
It'll make you go bald.
You know? Okay. So, is the minister, the paid minister, the pastor, or whatever, that person that's seen in preeminence, is that a biblical role? What do you think? Since it's in this book, I would say we can probably guess no, because that's what this book is talking about, right? Is it wrong to pay someone to be in that position? Okay? I don't think we could ever come to that conclusion, right? That it would be wrong. You can't go to somebody, y'all a preacher or what? You know? And it's never going to get to that point, right? But is it healthy? Is it the best situation that it can be?
Stumbling block in front of, you know, when you, that's just what kept coming back as I read this. For some reason that kept echoing in my thoughts was, you know, a stumbling block is, I don't know why, but except for the fact of putting all this pressure on this man, his family, his children, his extended family, you know, all this stuff, you're setting him up to fail and miserably fail at that. And I mean, I can't give a lot of examples, but there's, you know, there's so many people that I know of that's been in this situation that have not only just failed, but failed miserably, and horrible things have happened as a result of not being able to stand up to what the church expected.
So we just hired the wrong guy. He just wasn't the right guy for the job, right? So we'll bring some other guy in, you know? That's a great point. And we're gonna talk about some, and there's some statistics talked about in the book that I think you'll find a little bit amazing about the preacher himself and about, you know, the duties that he has and how difficult that really is on him. So where did it come from? All right, first thing, he talks in this book for several paragraphs about how our natural inclination is to exalt a leader, to have a leader and to put him on a pedestal and then depend on him, right? What is God's desire for his people? What has his desire always been for his people? Not necessarily.
Well, like, as God is the...
There you go.
Ahead, but like, he was, like, saying, you know, if you get a king, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going
to
happen. But
he wants to be our leader. God does. He said you don't need anybody else to be your leader. But every time he would say that, what would the people do? They'd look around, and they would see what people did. Everybody well, you know, they've got that leader, and they've got this leader. You know, that people wanted to exalt Moses in that position. Moses didn't want to be that, right? Moses, what the Bible calls him, the most humble man that's ever lived, right? Very humble. He didn't want to be that. But the people kept trying to push him, kept trying to exalt him into that position.
And why did they keep doing that? Because they didn't want the responsibility that was put on them.
Yeah.
They wanted to transfer that to someone else, because if I have to have a personal relationship with God, it holds me accountable.
Right.
If there's someone in between me and God, then I can look and say, well, he didn't do what he should have done, or I'd be okay. And we've taken that, all of the responsibilities that we should have, and transferred it to somebody else because we pay him to do that.
Well, God chose him, so I mean, that's got to be, you know. Need somebody to go up the mountain. Moses, go up the mountain. Get the law. Just give us the highlights.
As long as you're doing what we like.
Just give us 10 of them, okay? Just the highlights. So we don't need them all, Moses. Just give us the best ones. You know, the ones who couldn't follow those, right? But it's man's natural inclination in life to want to follow someone else for the most part. To exalt a leader. It takes the pressure off of the people. We'll let him deal with it. We'll let him be the mediator. We'll let him be the one that's responsible. And we'll just sort of take orders. We'll just sort of follow. It's so much easier.
And then grumble and complain.
And then complain about it. Like Rich says, you know, eat him, talk about him at lunch, you know. But it's always been that way in human history, and it's always been that way with God's people. We want to exalt a leader. But up until the 2nd century, we know when we look at the New Testament, there was no official leadership. There were no ministers, in the sense that we know them. There were no pastors or preachers in the sense that we know them. They weren't seen, even like the Apostle Paul and Peter. They didn't want to be exalted over everybody else. They had a role to fulfill. People came to Peter and they wanted to bow down to him. And what did he say? Get up. I'm just a man, just like you. Paul was the same way. They didn't want to be exalted. They wanted to just be a part of God's kingdom and fulfill the role that they had been given. They had been given a very special role, right? But they didn't want to be exalted over everyone else. They had a problem in Acts chapter 15. What did they do? Well, hey, you know what? Me and Peter, we'll just decide this one. Y'all just sit this one out. Okay, here's what we decide. What did they do?
In a meeting of the church.
They called the elders and the people all together, and they all came to a conclusion. Right, there was no exaltation. It was a leadership by committee. Until then, they started appointing elders, and then these elders were not seen as above anybody. In fact, the elders were seen as servants. They weren't seen as people that were supposed to be exalted above anyone. They were seen as servants. There were men like Philip and others who were evangelists, and sometimes they're called apostolic workers, that were trained just at the hand, at the feet of the apostles. And so after the apostles passed on, you had these guys who were like second generation apostles, right? They had trained. And so they were in all the churches, and they were going from church to church. And they were trying to keep things straight. They were talking to them about problems they were having and whatever, just like the apostles did. But if we see, like we talked about several weeks ago, the church was set up of people that were using their gifts, their talents, their abilities, the ones that God had given them. It was a very open, a very participatory atmosphere within the church. It wasn't a one-person rule or even a group rule. It was very open. I'm probably going to have to finish this next week. Okay, I'm just going to go through this real quick. And there's, like I said, there's a ton of other stuff that I'm not hitting with this. About sometime in the 100s, a guy named Ignatius came around. Anybody ever heard of Ignatius? Okay, that'd be a nice name for somebody's child. Ignatius, like that. There's several good names in this chapter. Really good. And Ignatius and the church at that time, they were having some leadership issues, and so they decided, well, you know, one thing we should probably do is we should probably just pick the best of the bishops, pick the best of the elders, and that guy we're going to call bishop. It wasn't any big deal, really. He was just sort of the head elder. Oh, wait, don't say that. He was just sort of the head guy that, you know, he was maybe the most experienced, or he was whatever, the most outspoken, the most respected. And so they elevated him just a little bit. Now, he's going to take charge of the meetings, and he's going to be the one that kind of makes sure that everything runs like it did. Well, what always happens when you get to that point? That person, not necessarily because they want it, the other elders are like, hey, this isn't too bad. He's getting all the blame. Here, do more. We'll just kind of help. You do more. So he became responsible for administering the Lord's Supper, for baptism, for counseling, for discipline, for marriages, for public prayer. Sound familiar? Sounds like the modern day preacher. He became responsible. And the other guys just sort of sit in the background. He was seen as the solution to internal problems. The solution to false doctrine. You know, you can't decide among a group of guys something, so we got this one guy. We all trust him. He's very high moral character and all this, and sure, it was meant very well. By the end of the second century, this is the way most churches were. After that, he became the main administrator, he became the manager of the money, he became the spiritual authority. And then, it wasn't too long until the bishops became a special class all their own. The bishops and the clerk, the presbyters, which were kind of his assistants, okay, the old elders, they became a class known as the clergy. They were just exalted one level above everybody else, and the bishop was a little level higher than those guys. Sound familiar? It's exactly the way it still is. Go into a hospital room after hours. Okay. Go into a hospital room after hours. Jeff. Okay. He's going to go visit somebody. He goes in and, sorry, sir, visiting hours are over. Well, I go to church with them, visiting hours are over. I go, I'm going to go. Can I go in? Sorry, visitor, I'm a minister. Please. I'm serious. I've been there. You pull into the parking lot at St. Thomas, you're like, in Vanderbilt, you're like, man, I can't even find a parking place. Free. Clergy. Okay. Parking place right by the door.
And it's free.
Handicapped people park further down than the clergy. It is, and it's free. You can get your car validated. Huh, it's awesome. That's the only time I plan to be clergy is when I get a close parking place to the door. Okay? So we'd pull in. We'd pull in, and sellers would pull out his little business card and set it on the dash. Anybody question? You know, we'd walk right in anytime we wanted to walk. Everywhere we wanted to walk, we could walk right into because we're ministers. You thought we were celebrities. It's not that great.
That's the only time.
It's not as great as it sounds. But the point is that even today there is that separation between the normal people and preachers and pastors and and ministers, right? There is a separation. And it came from way back when.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah.
I don't know many people that only just use their hands, or they just use one foot, or, they just use one eye. But if we're supposed to be the body of Christ, and yet we're saying, oh, we're going to let all these functions be placed on one person, I don't see that being any different than being, just using one hand for everything that you do, while the rest of it just kind of watches and is like, oh, okay, this got it. Bear comes by and starts attacking you. Oh, we'll send this hand out. It'll kill the bear by itself instead of using every part of us to take on what we need to take on.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's really our focus for next week's lesson is that exact point. What is the effect? What has the effect become? By 325, what happened in the 300s? Anybody know? Constantine. Okay. The church became the official religion of Rome, right? The official religion. And so Constantine was a Christian. And so what do you think he's going to do? He's going to give them all sorts of privileges. This is when they began to be paid by Rome. They were exempted from their taxes. They didn't go, if they did something wrong, they didn't go into the normal courts. They went into a special court reserved for people in their position. They were exempt from the military. They had a special class status. They dressed differently. They shaved their heads and they walked around in a very holy way so that everybody would know who they were. They were seen as something elevated in their status. And at this time they became known, believe it or not, the presbyters became known as priests, the bishop became known as the high priest. They actually called them that. And they thought about the role in the Old Testament. That's the relationship that they had between the people, which is exactly what God didn't want. Somebody to step in between and say, hey, let me take care of this. The high priest at this time began to be able to forgive sins. And it wasn't quite to the level of the Catholic Church yet, but this is when it kind of started. In the Middle Ages, and then on through things like this. They started believing in transubstantiation. Anybody know what that means?
The actual body of Christ is converted.
They said a little word, and I can't remember what it was. No, that's where abracadabra came from.
That is, that's
what that was. Hoc est corpus meum. Okay, some Latin word. I don't know.
Like Harry Potter.
It means, yeah, exactly. This is my body. And when they said that, the emblems turned into the body and the blood of Christ, literally, in their minds. And those guys were the only ones that had the power to make that happen. So what they had done is, anytime you were going to take the Lord's Supper, or the Eucharist, as they called it, you had to have the priest there. That's pretty much job security, right? You had to have those guys there, because they were the only ones that could say the words. And the words that would actually make the things happen.
It's still done that way today in Catholic Church. The priest is the one who puts the body in your mouth. You do not do it yourself.
Because you might drop a piece of it.
Well, and that can't happen. I think because you're not holy enough to touch it or something. Yeah. In Catholic Church, it's not.
Well, and then, basically what ended up happening, and this is kind of what you're talking about. Basically what happened is that the bishop, okay, this high priest figure, he moved kind of out of the actual doing anything, and he kind of moved to the background, or the foreground, whichever we want to say. And he had his servants, the rest of the elders, okay, they became the priests, the ones that actually did the work, like in the Old Testament. And the high priest just oversaw everything and was the figurehead, the one that everybody looked at. Oh, the high priest. What do you think eventually happened with this? This high priest then became a very high political figure. He had political power then. And he was able to he was high in the culture, but also high in the church. You can see movies like Three Musketeers, different movies like that, where you have the evil bishop, the guy that's kind of take, well, because he was eaten up with political power. It had so ingrained in him that he had to have that power that he did things that were not very Christian. Eventually, this bishop they started doing it like, you know, this region would have a bishop that was in charge. The best one of them, they choose one. Well, and then they had one that was in Rome, and it seems like they changed his name pretty soon after that to the Pope. Now you can kind of understand kind of where that's headed. Next week we're going to start class by looking at some guys that tried to change some stuff. Okay, the reformers. And how they tried, but they didn't do a very good job. They didn't go far enough. They just only went to a certain point and then they quit. They didn't really go all the way out when they saw these things.
Because
the people wouldn't follow them, and you know, they didn't want to get beheaded, which was probably a bad thing.
Hard to keep your message out there.
Yeah, pretty bad, pretty much. Okay, I'm finished. I'll pick up next week right there. Thanks for your.